All right. Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of Show Me State of Mind, our wonderful cold open. I'm sitting here with our wonderful guest and producer, Megan, who I look forward to introducing you over time. But we're excited today. And again, welcome to another great episode of Show Me State of Mind. All right. Again, welcome to Show Me State of Mind. And I'm Brent McGinney, your host and CEO, president of the Missouri Behavioral Health Council. And it is my honor to have another wonderful guest join us today. And that is my friend. I have got other words to describe this great person, but Marcia Morgan from Kansas City is joining us today to talk about an issue near and dear to her heart. And we have a great history together. We just spent some time before the episode started talking about old times. And I'm going to get into a little bit how I got to know you and how our work together has kind of grown out of that relationship. But let's first start by introducing you to our listeners, many of you who probably know you, but some who maybe don't. But you came out of the behavioral health system in Missouri through various roles, as I remember, even before I got to know you. But could you kind of talk to the listener, introduce yourself to them about kind of what you did in Missouri and how you grew up to kind of ultimately, I'll spoil it, become, you know, chair of the Missouri Behavioral Health Council and get to work with me and some of the things that you've led for our system that we're going to talk a lot more about. But before that, you kind of grew up in the Missouri system. Can you describe how that started, where you came from, and all those different roles that you served in?
Sure. And thanks, Brent, for actually wanting me to be here with you today. This is very cool. So I actually grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. And
Kansas City.
No, not Kansas City. I migrated west when I was a young professional. But yeah, no, I actually say for everybody, I've been a lifelong person in the mental health field because I had family who had serious and persistent mental illness. And in my professional career, I started out as an activity aide and became a recreational therapist at Mid-Missouri Mental Health Center, which is now, I think, Psychiatric Receiving Center in Columbia.
In Columbia, yeah.
And then transferred. Well, I was a cab driver too for a while, but I transferred to.
They call those Uber drivers now, right? Yeah.
Well,
that little side business.
Yes. Yeah. That was in between my professional career and transferred then to Western Missouri Mental Health Center, which is currently Center for Behavioral Medicine in Kansas City.
Yeah. State of that, you were a state employee then.
Yeah, for 23 years.
Yeah.
And when the state decided that, around the time of managed care, and the state decided that the state-owned, state-operated community mental health centers couldn't do risk-based contracting anymore. We were privatized. And so in 1997, I became part of Truman Medical Center and was in the position of Chief Operating Officer for Behavioral Health for Truman until I retired in 2016.
Yeah, so that was how many years then? So
altogether 42 by the time I retired.
Altogether, but yeah, you were at Truman in charge of behavioral health for nearly the entire
19
time,
years.
Right?
But 19
yeah, 19 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, so you were on the board of Missouri Behavioral Health Council. We talked about it like back when it was Kathy and Paula.
Yes.
And that's it. And
yes.
Then you were there and you were chair for me sometime after I started. So I started in last day of 2012. And it wasn't that many years past then,
right,
of course, since you retired when
Four.
You did, that you were the board chair for me. And
yes.
I remember very distinctly there were different things chair people would like to focus on. And you came to me very early and were like, Brent, this thing called trauma, we're not doing as good as we should be. We need to be doing better and just know I'm going to want to focus on it as chair. And I kind of remember being like, okay, then if the board chair wants it, that's what we're going to do. And so we did have some champions of trauma in our system. You were clearly one of them, but things were, Missouri kind of led in the trauma space with some early adopters and some things that were happening. Can you kind of talk about the early world of trauma before Sure. we jump forward and talk about the cool stuff you're doing for our system now? But there was a beginning.
There was a beginning, and that is really thanks to the Missouri Department of Mental Health. And Robin Boosted, who is no longer with us, and Patsy Carter actually were able to secure some funding. And we had in 2008, 2009, a national consultant who came in, and we were offered the opportunity to have early adopters. And our early adopters included a number of the members of the Missouri Behavioral Health Council, and then a couple like Division of Youth Services who also joined in the early adopters. And we kind of took off and were given, and Roger Fallot was our national consultant, and Roger provided us with all kinds of resources and helped us really understand what trauma was. I had staff previously in the early 2000s who came to me and said, oh, I went to this conference and I learned about this trauma stuff and we need to be doing it. And I did just what a lot of other presidents and CEOs do. Well, yeah, we'll get to it. And when Roger, it was probably the very first conference that we had with our national consultants, and I'm driving down to Jeff City, right? Yeah. And I've been in the business 35 years, and I'm thinking, I know all about trauma and what are they going to tell me, but I want to be an early adopter, and you know, I'll take advantage of anything that anybody gives me. And so we're sitting in this workshop in the governor's office, right? And what he says is, he says, now, here are some things that you should be doing if you're trauma-informed. And one of the things you should be doing is asking permission to shut the door, because otherwise you might be triggering people. And my brain was exploding, because in 35 years, nobody had ever said, when you meet with patients, ask permission to shut the door. It's just shut the door for confidentiality purposes or privacy purposes. And it was like, oh my gosh, if I don't know this, and I've been in the business for 35 years, everybody needs to know it. And I'm going back and I'm going to change it. Truman Medical Center, and I'm going to change behavioral health. And we're going to do all the things that we need to do in order to be trauma informed. The other thing that became very, very clear, Brent, was that we were doing a really, really bad job in assessing our clients and the impact of trauma. And we didn't, you know, you do social histories, right? And your social histories include, well, my mother didn't want me, or, you know, I was beat up, or whatever those social histories are. But we never incorporated what happened to kids into thinking about what it meant in terms of their physical health or their mental health. And you know, we had this great study that was done in the mid-90s. That told us that there is huge impact on people, not just mentally, but physically and socially and financially, about what happens to people when they have serious adversity in their childhood, and that our brains actually change. And it's like, from that point forward, I was passionate.
Like your history, your work in the field, and being ready at that time for all those reasons in your life, just when you're hearing that message, just that direct, you know, eureka moment of this is really important, and I can improve in this area. This is an area where I could really, not only for my agency, but even like an early adopter being part of the initial movement almost, right? Because it was an opportunity where research met an opportunity in Missouri with some money and some early visionaries in the field, a great consultant who came in and then that resonated with those leaders that there's several of you in the field still that are still working on it in Missouri, which is quite remarkable. But yeah, you guys kind of developed, you know, it has a name. It was called Missouri Model. It's kind of transformed over time, but you guys did kind of develop, I think, a way of kind of explaining what it was to people. You know, we then started working on getting it across all of our agencies, as I recall. And that was a big part of what you wanted us to do when you were chair, is that this is going to be something we're going to adopt a collaborative around this. And we're going to really kind of push that Missouri model. So kind of describe those early days of the early adoption, kind of establish some of those things, but then we did push it out, right? To get it across our entire system.
Yeah, we certainly did. And one of the things that happened for the early adopters, and again, DMH really supported and sponsored this for the first few years, is we developed what we call the Missouri Roundtable. And the roundtable was the early adopters plus any other organizations that were actually taking the initiative, doing innovative work around trauma. And so we met really once a year, but we would meet like, you know, every once in a while we'd have a meet. It was a conference call. We didn't have virtual meetings.
Yeah, we weren't COVID Zooming then.
No, we were not. We were not. And, you know, and we would get together and we would say, what is it that we think we need to work on? Right. And over the next year, and, you know, and we'd put together work groups. And one of the very first work groups was, what are the principles that are going to drive this work? And we settled on five core principles of safety, trustworthiness, choice, collaboration, and empowerment. And we worked on and cultural responsiveness, cultural humility, cultural competence. So it was those five core principles. And what we said is all of the issues around culture are embedded in safety, trustworthiness, choice, collaboration, and empowerment. Cultural differences don't stand separate, right? Mm-hmm. But we called it out. And after the principles were developed, then what started happening is we started hearing from organizations that would go to a 2-hour session or do a, can I say Reliance? That did a Reliance workshop, and they would say, oh, well, we're trauma informed.
Right.
And it's like, you go into their organization and they're not.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there are lots of things that are not trauma informed at all.
We did learn, like with suicide prevention and other things, like it's an organizational issue. It's not one type of provider.
Right.
It truly is. Trauma crosses that. It's an organizational health.
It's a culture.
Organizational cultural issue. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we said, well, okay, if organizations are not really trauma informed, if they aren't operating really at that level, what is it that we can do that would help them? You know, and we heard that. And we also heard, we would go to an organization and say, we've got this great information and we want to share it with you. And we want to tell everybody about it. And we'd get that, I've got 17 other things on my plate. I don't have time for it. I don't have the budget for it, whatever. And so the Missouri Roundtable then developed the Missouri Model, the continuum. And that's trauma aware, sensitive, responsive, and informed. Right. And so it's like there's a 4-step process, and we developed definitions around each of those stages. And then we developed indicators and resources, and we published that through the Department of Mental Health. And so it's out in the public domain, and organizations then were like, oh, okay, so here's what I need to, you know, to be trauma aware. all we're asking people really is just to understand the definition of what is trauma, right? And then at Trauma Sensitive, we're really saying everybody in your organization should be trained. They should at least have some concept about what is, not only what is trauma, but what is resilience and what are, you know, what is it that is happening to the brain?
Yeah.
And then at the trauma responsive level, we're talking about really looking at your policies and your practices. And then at trauma informed, it's really begins to be that state of being and really then really starting to push organizations to think about advocacy. Yeah. So the way that I think of it today is aware is the learning phase. And then sensitive is really the thinking phase, right? Because organizations, people in organizations really need to think through what it is that should be happening to them, you know, and to start paying attention. I mean, when you walk in, when you walk into an organization, you walk into their rating room, there should be, you should feel calm. You should feel welcomed. You should feel like you belong there, right? And so there are environmental things that you can do to make sure that you people feel safe, right? And then so it's learning, thinking, and then the third stage at that responsive stage is really I start doing stuff.
Yeah.
I try it. And some things work and some things don't, right? And then at the informed stage, that is truly your stage of being. You know, it's just how I am.
Well, it's how I do it. Just a couple things that I can't let go before we move on. But the, you know, we got the big new CI project from Governor Parson and the legislature, you know, $75 million plus another really $20 million. So about $95 million of projects, CI projects funded to help a variety of things from our dual diagnosed bid population to new clinic space, new residential space. And I just can't tell you how many times I was discussing those projects with people. And when you get trauma in your culture, when they're looking at new construction, new buildings, it was like second nature or second hand to them that they're like, how do we design this with that in mind? You know, Vicki Meisler did a great job after the tornado of bringing up trauma-informed spaces. And then that's really carried forward with the design across. So if you think about it, the whole generational physical space of who we are, I was really educated by some of those early efforts that you all did. And that's kind of pretty darn cool to see the physical manifestation of that cultural shift in our agencies that kind of came out of that work. And that's really something to be applauded. So, you know, congratulations on that, because I see it all the time. And that's good. That's good. That must feel good. I hope it does.
It does feel good.
I can't let it go without another great lesson you taught me. And this is funny. I hope people, I've used this 100 times. And so I was working on, I think at the time it was maybe CBHL. We called them CMHLs back in the day when they first started, but it was just a way of better connecting to law enforcement. Everybody was for it. We were all for it, but you know, it just brought another referral source into our system where we have a workforce that is somewhat limited in many cases. And that, you know, CCBHC has helped that today because we're actually competitive with salaries. But when Marcia and I were around back in 2012 to 16, you know, we were on old fee for service. We had cap allocations. We had crappy fee for service rates. You know, our payrolls, we couldn't compete for psychiatry, therapists. It was just a tough marketplace, right?
I mean, yeah, it was awful.
And Marcia said, you know, Brent, you're doing such a good job on bringing these new programs in and referrals, but it's like you're adding on ramps to a 2-lane highway.
Right.
And you keep adding on ramps, but we need to expand the highway. And I really always loved that kind of metaphor for our system because it did reveal and was very clear to me when I used that with lawmakers and others. And in my advocacy for CCBHC is, you know, Health Home, wonderful program. CMHL, wonderful program. You know, you just keep adding these additional layers, all wonderful, school-based, but you're just pulling it from another part of your workforce. It's not easy to backfill that. And just it was just kind of this real important lesson to me that you better be paying attention to your highway.
Yeah.
If you're going to add all this other cool on-ramps. So that is, I've used that a ton since then, Marcia. So thank you. And I hope our system's been, I attribute it to you. So whether or not you came up with it, it's too late in Missouri. It's your quote.
But, yeah, it was more like a dirt road.
Yeah, it was not even a too late highway.
In some of our rural areas, yeah. Boy, people were just struggling, and the work is hard.
Yeah.
It's hard enough
to recruit into that, let alone without the pay and the other things that you do. So, yeah, I think I'm most proud of, not that it's solved, it hasn't, but the one benefit of CCBHC is just the ability to be at least competitive to where if you find those passionate people who love the work, at least they can't use, I could get 40% more if I did this over here. If you can get close, sometimes those passionate people they'll be attractive and they'll stay. But, if you can't be at least competitive in the ballpark, it's understandable why people weren't staying.
Well, when you can go to a retail, whether it's Costco or Sam's and make as much. And, Brent, in all of the site visits that I've done with the organizations as they become CCBHCs, after the heavy lift, people have, say it's the best thing that's ever happened to the system. So
yeah,
congratulations on CCBHC. I got out.
You got out. I got out before the heavy lift.
Yes, before the heavy lift.
That's right. Well, so now let's get to kind of more today. So you are going to retire and you and I are talking because, trauma doesn't stop being a passion for you. You knew I'm going to keep doing work because it's what I want to do is when I retire. And at the time we're talking, I think if I remember, I'm sure I don't get the timing of this perfectly accurate, but we're thinking we got the collaborative, we still got work to do. You come to me if I remember or vice versa with an idea of, I've got a little team of folks that I know that love this work that we should, I'm going to maybe start a consulting business around this. And then kind of mashed into that at some point after a little time. So Resilience Builders is a kernel of idea. We're going to gather some of our learnings under that umbrella and let's keep this thing going. And I love that. And so, how can we support that piece? It kind of fits with CCBHC. The timing was right. I loved all of it. And then we kind of talk a little bit about Resilience Builders, how you brought that up, your great little, I call it the small but mighty team. And then like that discussion we had about how do we measure it and what does that look like? And because that'd be really important, I think. And you were like, let me think on that. And then kind of what that led to. So that's like a mini part question, but like how cool was that time in a way to think what a great opportunity for us to, you were getting to where you had time and then could really focus on trauma and then how great that's been kind of in what you've created. So kind of give us that story because it's really cool.
Yeah, so in 2015, so it was right before I retired. In 2015, the council started the Trauma-Informed Learning Collaborative. And there were 7 or 8 agencies that were at the pre-institute conference down in Branson, actually. Mm-hmm. And Raul Almazar was our national consultant who you guys brought in. And so we did the 3-day training. And then somehow, mutually, we decided that I would support the organizations as they were working on putting together their work in their organizations. And Raul and I did a number of site visits in the organizations, and he's amazing. If anybody ever has an opportunity to meet Raul, he's a nurse and he, again, lives and breathes this stuff. Anyways, after a couple years, it was pretty clear that he was moving on and, finances change. And so you guys just kept allowing me to consult and work with the organizations and to do the learning collaborative. And so we've been working on this learning collaborative. We call it a collaborative almost 10 years. And over that time, one of the things that, and this is you saying, you know, Marsha, I'm spending this money, but I don't know if we're getting anywhere, right? And we, even though we had action plans, the other thing that was starting to happen too, Brent, was people were doing the simple stuff. So, you know, hanging up pictures that, you know, were reflective of the people you serve, or change the colors on the walls, right? Or maybe there was an employee engagement committee, or, you know, or orientation kinds of activities. But then people were like, we don't know what else to do. And the other thing that was happening nationally at the in the field of trauma is we started learning about epigenetics, and we really started, you know, blowing out the brain science, not blowing up the brains, but blowing out the science, so that it was like, there's so much more to this, right? And so what we started doing then was, And you were like, how do I measure? How do I know that this investment that I'm making with you is actually netting anything? And in 2017, it was just by happenstance that I met with a couple folks who actually have an amazing platform. And it was like, we can develop, you would be the content experts. We can develop this assessment tool, the creative leadership. What they do is, I mean, they've done assessments like with DOD and, you know, with a number of federal agencies. So they have the platform. And it was like, oh man, this I can
so cool.
I can measure. I can do what Brent's asking. Because the other thing that and you and I had this conversation, I had done site visits.
Yeah.
Probably at every organization that was participating in the Learning Collaborative. And you were like, well, Marsha, tell me which ones are like where on the continuum. And I was like, not me.
I don't want to.
Not me. That's a political. I'm not going to.
I'm going to say Marsha said.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Remember your friend?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah. So it was like, I don't think I'm going to do it that way. Yeah. So we spent almost, well, better part of a year to develop what we call now the Trauma-Informed Culture Assessment, or the TICA. And we were very intentional about aligning the indicators. So in the assessment, there's 48 indicators, and the indicators align, if you think of a matrix, they align according to the continuum. So they align with aware, sensitive, responsive, and informed. They also, though, align with safety, trustworthiness, choice, collaboration, and empowerment. So you can look at where you are, and let me say what was really important to me. It's interesting. People want to know where they are on the continuum, right? Because people want to be able to put a gold star up on their wall or whatever. My interest was, are you helping keep people safe? And are you helping, you know, build relationship? And are you doing that with everybody that you work with, right? And everybody that you serve. So while the organizations, I think, are very interested in where do they stand on the continuum, I'm interested in knowing, how are you treating people?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And are the policies and are the practices aligning with the principles? Because the principles are universal.
Right.
I mean, and the principles are more than just for trauma and being trauma informed. The principles are foundational to making sure that everybody feels like they belong.
Yeah.
Everybody feels included. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
If it doesn't matter who you are, if you're not safe, you're not safe.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And
as leaders, like you led an organization for many years, and there's a certain level of ego that comes along with that. And to be honest, to say, and open enough to say, I want to know and I want to get better. I think we all want to get better, but it's hard sometimes to say certain level of one. And I think we have good leaders like that in our system and are blessed with it. But, you know, kudos to them for understanding that this is important and we need to be open to measuring that and really listening to our employees. And I imagine just the step of taking a group, you've seen this with each agency that's come on, appointing a group to really be leaders on this and for that leader to empower that group to do that. And imagine that Tika, you mentioned that assessment you developed. I mean, number one, incredible. It's just amazing. But, you know, describe like the participation in that is just amazing. Like,
it is.
It's just remarkable when you get survey results of 10, 15, 20, you know, I think like 50 something or 60 is considered like this massive number, but you guys are hitting stuff that is pretty amazing, and
we should
be really proud of that. And your work with our system to be accepted enough to really push that amongst the employees is remarkable, I think.
I think so too. And, you know, it is an employee-based assessment. It's confidential. It's online, and our people can do it on paper, but mostly in the behavioral health and at MBHC, the folks that participate actually do it online. We shoot for a 70% completion rate. I think last year we were at 69-68%, something like that. Yeah. And, you know, the other neat thing about the assessment is you can slice and dice the data. So there's 9 filters, I think, and based on age or length of service or race and ethnicity, by position, if you've experienced primary trauma or secondary trauma. So when you get the assessment, the other part of the assessment that is really neat is we can, once it closes, we can turn that around and get that out to organizations within a week or so.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And so people get the data right away. Yeah. I mean, basically right away. And then the other thing that one of my team members developed while she was on maternity leave is we now have, one of the things that we kept hearing from folks is we know what we need to improve, but we don't know what to do. Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. So she decided that.
Yeah. Or we've done X, Y, Z and we feel like we're just kind of plateaued there.
Yeah. So there were a couple things. One is we kept hearing from the Learning Collaborative members that onboarding was not being well done. Right? Just generally onboarding's not being well done. Well, if you're not onboarding new employees, how can they feel safe? Yeah. Right? How can they feel empowered? How can they collaborate if they don't know what in the world they're supposed to be doing or they don't know what the rules are? So anyway.
I'd giggle just because producer Megan knows this. We're a work in progress here at MBHC. And my theory on that's always been like, hey, just be patient with us for a couple weeks. And, you know, you'll start picking stuff up. You know, what a terrible onboarding. So we tried to be a little better at it. But I giggle because that's awful of me, too. I how could you not be safe here? It's a wonderful place to work. You should know that. And welcome.
Yeah.
And we'll take you out to lunch once. And, you know, I mean, but yeah, we try to humor our way through it. But you really do owe it to employees to, you know, be as thoughtful about it and as welcoming and as safety oriented as, like you said, as you can be. And so I always feel like I owe everybody here an apology for all the onboarding over the past so many years that we've probably just muddled through. But you're right. It is such a critical component. And I don't mean to minimize it by laughing. It's just more of a self-realization over time that, goodness sakes, we should have, could have, and should have done better over these years.
Well, and when you're small,
and we are smaller.
I mean, you know, it's easy to just say, hi, I'm Bren, or hi, I'm Megan. And, you know,
they see me a lot.
So, but, and so anyway, so every indicator, so every of all of the indicators, all 48 of them, have some ideas around action planning or action items that you can take for onboarding, right? The other thing that we've heard is, and we've heard from the committees, the trauma-informed committees at organizations, is my leader just doesn't quite get it. They're really busy and, you know, they just don't get it. And when we go and ask for something or we say that the policy needs to be changed, we get pushback because they don't really get it. Mm-hmm. So the other set of action items that we've developed with every indicator is around leadership. And within those action items, there's also quality measures. So people have, here's something that you can do, and here's something that you can measure. If, you know, as, and what I've tried to do, again, Brent, because in healthcare, we don't need more measures, right? I mean, we already have tons and tons of measures. So it's like, here's how it aligns with your safety indicators, right? Or here's how it aligns with your turnover rates. Or so we've tried to be mindful of what most organizations are probably already measuring anyway, so that, again, they can try something and then they can measure it based on what they're already measuring.
I think you mentioned talking to someone before we kind of started today about how they use it in their managements, how important those scores are to them. And I hear that from several leaders, that whether it's their board wants to know about it, and it's something that has kind of become an oversight and something to, you know, be thoughtful of and brag about and focus on, which is wonderful. I know, in a way, that it's kind of you always hope that's what it would become. And I think we're starting to see that, and that's really wonderful. So, something else, I won't get emotional about this, but you've had a partner here at MBHC for a long time on this, our good friend, Katie Horseman.
Yes.
And she has been a wonderful, I think, partner and leader on this that often goes kind of unheralded because she's here at the council and kind of behind the scenes supporting those things. And I just want to give her a shout because
Katie's
amazing. Been a real leader in this, hasn't she?
Yes, yeah. Katie's amazing. And her support and her encouragement has meant everything. And, you know, so yes, she's, you probably don't pay her enough.
That's it. Producer, cut that last part out from Marcia. No, I'm just kidding. But you're right. She, you know, we just did recently move her up to the most senior level of management here. It's long overdue. She's just a rock star. And I know this is such a near and dear to her heart kind of thing. And so just letting you two kind of run with it has been just so fun to watch. And I feel like I've been along for the ride and just rooting you guys on, but it's really been a special kind of relationship for you two, I know. But
one of the things that I have most appreciated about Katie is when you guys come up with ideas, she reaches out to us to say, have you thought about this? Would you like to do this? And it's like, we can do that. Yeah. It fits right in with what we're doing, and it fits right in with my background and my experience. Yeah. So
I really love that, you know, you're talking about a few occasions where that's happened, but this idea of, hey, these two measurements we're doing are kind of pretty close, and feedback from our providers on, is that something that could maybe be combined around some work we're doing with another group around, and, you know, they cost XYZ, but we've got this other measuring tool over here. Could that be, you know, and just the openness to kind of think of ideas and working with the providers, come up with these more efficient, like you said, we already have so much measurement. Let's not try to duplicate it I just appreciate that relationship's been wonderful. And I think the providers really appreciate it. And because, you know, we still do too many surveys and we do too many things. So that, you know, to the extent we can, working to get more efficient has been really a cool side feature of things.
And we felt, because of the feedback that we get and because of the relationships that we have with the agencies, you know, we've developed like the trauma-informed supervision workshops and, you know, the middle management workshop and, you know, the orientation and training.
Which is incredibly well received, by the way, the middle management workshop. So thank you for doing all that. It ranks higher than any other group we brought in to do middle management. Don't tell them. But it's really well received and fills up very quickly.
Well, we love doing that. And the trauma-informed supervision piece is really for frontline supervisors, our potential emerging kind of folks who might be in a supervisory role. And one of your organizations has had me do that probably 8 or 9 times now. And again, we fine-tuned it, but it is also very well received. And again, part of it is people, and you've seen it, Brent, all the time. People get promoted, but they don't get any orientation. It's figure it out.
Yeah.
I mean, just figure it out. Or, you know, they get promoted and they've had bad supervisors. And so they know they don't want to be that, but then they become like on the other end of counselors and therapists, and you can't be that either as you're a supervisor, right?
Yeah.
So it's trying to help people, you know, walk that line and develop. Again, it's everything that I do. My background really is a recreational therapist. And so everything that I do is very task focused, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, we got to understand the concepts, but then you got to know what in the world are you supposed to do, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, here's how you deal with somebody who's, you know, failing to perform. And here's how you hold people accountable, and you can do it, right?
Yeah.
So that's some of what we, again.
Very well received. I think we're all, at least for me, so many of the spaces we live in because of our environment around us are edgy and tense. And, you know, we all know what we're talking about. Our political environment seems as divided as ever. And, you know, your own families and just all the things that we deal with, you're looking for some concrete examples that are rooted in just bedrock principles of how we deal with one another and how we can be positive yet still get the job done and have to do that part too. And you're just looking for, I think, concreteness that makes sense. And so I think people are attracted to that, and you just do a great job. But let's think about, like, so you do all this amazing stuff here in Missouri with the MBHC folks, and our system's grateful to you. We're grateful to you. But, you know, all of a sudden people start kind of hearing about this, I think, a little bit. So talk about, like, if you had like a, you know, unlimited supply of people, this thing, I think, blows up even more than it has. But talk about like other systems that kind of came to you. I know we don't have forever, but, and other states, countries, just folks are hungry for this, I think.
They are. And especially when they start really understanding how it impacts their own personal lives. I mean, I've had people really say, you know, this has meant as much to me in my relationship with my family as it's meant to me, you know, in my work environment. And so that we've done some work with, like, we administered the TICA to like a managed care company, right? And boy, they have a lot to learn. I'll just, you know, in terms of really thinking about how they serve people and what their expectations are for people and what their expectations are for their provider community. And so, and we've worked with homeless folks, homeless shelters, actually in Sarasota. So our hearts right now are really divided and thinking about what's going on with Hurricane Milton in Sarasota. And it's been interesting. I serve on a board called the Campaign for Trauma-Informed Policy and Practice at the national level. It was founded by really some of the top experts in trauma. So like Sandy Bloom and Andy Blanche and David Chern, and, you know, and anyway, I don't know why I'm on it, Brent, because there's people from the East Coast and the West Coast, and then there's kind of me.
I know why you're on it.
so one of the fellow board members who's in Philadelphia, she's used the Tika a lot, and you know, she's a person who I know does a lot across the country, and she says, what you ask, what you do, is this is better than any of the other assessments that there are. So I say that humbly because it's, you know, we try to recognize, like, there's the attitudes related to trauma-informed care that was developed at Tulane, but they're measuring attitudes. They're not measuring, you know, it's like, do you believe that people have trauma? Do you believe that people, you know, are triggered by trauma? I mean, yes, you need, you know, it's an attitude scale, right?
Just different.
Yeah, which is different than, is your organization practicing safety, you know? So that's kind of where we are. And, you know, we just continue to respond to when people ask us for, you know, and I think my young team, I hammer them about when we do this, we're going to do it. Excellent. We're going to be excellent. We're not going to be perfect, but we're going to be excellent. And they're so far ahead of me, Brent. I mean, they're doing videos, right? And learning videos, training videos, that kind of thing.
Taking it to that next level of how to move on from a more interactive way of teaching and not just on paper and all the. Yeah. Well, again, it's cool to be on the ride with you, Marcia, and I'm so proud. And I want to wrap up a little bit. I think you mentioned the national group, and I think in Missouri, one of the things that kind of sets some of what we do apart and has kind of kept us maybe with a little more strength as a system is, you know, we're not afraid to embed something like trauma into a standard. So if you want to be a CCBHC here, you've got to embrace that that's a key component of who you are as an organization. You're going to be a healthcare home, and you're going to be trauma-informed, and you may not be perfect, but it's going to be a principle that you have to participate in to be at that standard. And I don't think a lot of states might look at those minimum 9 core standards and that's it. But Missouri said no, because of the work you've laid down here and the leadership of Vicki Meisler and other early adopters, and don't want to start using names because I'll forget a bunch, but we had a lot of great leadership early. And because of that, it became, that is going to be the standard. And sure enough, that's now embedded in our actual standards of CCBHC and things like that, which I think that's really kind of awesome that we take that leap. And so, but think about, I always think that nationally, how important it's going to be that we get SAMHSA and CMS and other of those kind of federal bodies to recognize that, because you could probably not find a worse trauma-informed practice than the GIPRA in the SUD space or other very just in-depth triggering, before we even talk to you, can we ask you these invasive, awful questions that could trigger you before we even get a relationship of trust built or even started?
Right.
And all the barriers we put up to good care that are regulatory, and I think is something that is I know you're working nationally, your group is, but it's something that we really need our federal regulators to understand, that we're all about being accountable. We're all about providing data, but you can't create these just awful practices and try to throw them on providers who then you want to develop these trusting therapeutic relationships to people.
And Brent, that kind of gets to, I guess, why I do this work, is because what I saw in my own organization, right, is, let me say it different, we're treating symptoms. We're not getting to the root cause. And the root cause is trauma. And when you deal in the root cause and you start really understanding what is happening in people's brains, and you know, I mean, and just as a quick example, you know, some of the research now is saying that hallucinations and delusions are really flashbacks. They're from early childhood, right? Well, if we're treating it as schizophrenia, when what it really is trauma, then we aren't doing the right work, yeah. right? And it's the same thing. And then you take a look, COVID being, you know, an issue, climate change being an issue, we have to address what it is that's happening to people's brains. And, you know, and whether it's PET scans, whether it's, you know, cortisol testing, we need to know so that we can really help our people. So there's this whole science that is still undeveloped. So yes, there's all policies and procedures and yeah, some of these crazy regulations that aren't getting us to where we need to go. And then there's this other piece in terms of the care and the treatment that we all receive because it's in our bodies.
Yeah.
You know, Dr. Bessel van der Kolk says the body keeps the score. Well, if your body and Megan's body and my body all have had trauma and we all get triggered, how do we work together? How do we be productive? How do we be creative if we're a mess?
Yeah. And that's why I really think this ties a lot together. And you've been very gracious with your time. We're going to be respectful and wrap up soon. But like the culture in Missouri that I'm so proud that you all have built and we've tried to continue it is not to be afraid of best practices, not to be to run towards collecting the data that's important, to not be afraid of ranking and scoring and sharing who's doing well and why, and learning from that and bringing examples to collaboratives. And so I think of that when you got folks pushing on early episode psychosis, you got folks pushing on brain science, and kudos to our former Senator Roy Blunt, who's CCBHC and record levels of funding for NIH and National Institutes of Health and Mental Health, and how important he knew that research into the brain was. Just you bring all that together and trying to stay on that cutting edge of don't be afraid of that data. Don't be afraid of adopting things early and learning from each other. And I think that culture is what we need to kind of stay on the edge a little of better care for the citizens of Missouri, which ultimately is what we're trying to get to. And that's why it benefits the economy. It benefits all those things we talked about earlier. So,
well, and it will help all of our generations.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's old people have trauma that is unresolved, right? And that is impacting their health. And our Gen Zs and our next gen, whose name I don't remember, I think their alphas are polars or something.
Sometime we're supposed to not know the ones that far away. Like, yeah, I know they're going to take care of us, but maybe we should know them. Yeah,
but right. I mean, again, if how do we help them be all that they can be if we aren't paying attention to the brain development and in their health and well-being, which is, you know, part of why we have a certified professional trainer who's getting more certification on health and wellness stuff, because it's all interrelated.
Yeah, right. Well, again, you've been very gracious with your time. You drove all the way here to be in a room with us, which is always appreciated. It's not that I dislike a good old Zoom meeting, but there's nothing quite like being here together. And so we appreciate spending this time with you, Marcia, and learning more. I hope our listeners appreciate that some of the things, you know, that we do and are known for really start with, you know, some passionate people willing to step up and do the hard work. And you've been that to our system. And so we're so grateful. And thanks for your friendship.
No, thank you. Thanks for letting me be here.
Great. Thank you so much.